accession number 12502, Reel 10.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Reel 10.
And of course, there's a lot on the reorganisation in this book, of course, because it deals with the Chiefs of Staff, which is very much a... But this was fascinating working for Mountbatten because, you know, there are two. You know, I worked for him, and then that was in 62, and then in 82, 20 years later, I did the job he was doing. So that was quite interesting.
What sort of man was he to work for?
Well, he was one of those larger-than-life characters. There's no doubt about it. He had glaring strengths and weaknesses. But he... I mean, in a sense, he was a genius. He could deal with things on two different levels. He could deal with the bigger picture. He could worry about the right voltage or ampage and the plugs for the television cameras. He had an eye for detail and a big vision at the same time. I suppose the amazing thing about him was his incredible capacity for work, really. Incredible. I mean, he had the same sort of energy as Winston Churchill had, this incredible capacity for work. Anything you gave him to decide on when his box went away in the evening, he would have back to you the next morning, even though he may have had a state banquet or banquet at the Guild Hall or dinner party here or some important visitor staying overnight. Next morning you would have everything back. Incredible capacity for hard work. Driving ambition. Determination to do all the things that he wanted to do by fair means or foul. They don't come like that more than very occasionally in a generation. But he was a very circuitous person. He almost preferred the indirect and the direct approach. One of the difficulties of my job was that he and the chiefs of staff were always in intense opposition with one another. Anything he suggested, they were against.
Why was that? Was it that he aroused personal resentment?
Well, he did arouse personal resentment. They didn't trust him. Gerald Templer didn't trust him. He aroused personal thing. He thought they went round and back, that he wasn't always telling the truth. He knew that they knew he wasn't always telling the truth. He thought the end justified the means. And partly because he had visions which didn't coincide with their conservative views on the responsibility of the chiefs of staff. I mean, they did not want to break this intense link between power to advise and responsibility to carry out, which was vested in the three individual chiefs of staff. He wanted to centralize and control and direct, and he wanted to have a more responsive system, which I think he was right over. And he wanted to take some of the powers from the chief and invest it in his own office of Chief of Defence Staff. And this has been gradually being done over the last 10 years, of course. And so they opposed, rightly or wrongly, everything that he suggested. And the way that the defence reorganisation was done, bearing in mind the suspicion that they held Mountbatten, was that Macmillan cleverly got two wise men, Jacob and Ismay, but Jacob did most of the work, to write this report and say what needed to be done. He got the cabinet approval, and then the chiefs of staff more or less had to comply. The trouble was that the chiefs on one hand and Mountbatten on the other interpreted the decision in a slightly different way. Mountbatten that they should do rather more centralisation than was spelt out, and the chiefs that they should do slightly less. And so there was this ever, and I was the meat, of course, in the sandwich as far as my own service was concerned. And I was serving Mountbatten and the reorganization, and therefore was held in quite suspicion by my own service. I mean, the director of our staff duties once said to me, "Colonel, you don't want your battalion," because after that I was going to command a battalion, "you don't want your battalion taken away from you, do you?" And I said, "General, you must be joking." But he wasn't joking at all. And this was because I was thought to be too identified with the central approach as opposed to the individual service approach. This is a penalty that you have to pay for being a joint, or you did have to pay for being a joint person. Now, of course, it's not so much.
Do you think that Mountbatten had derived his ideas from his experience of running combined operations?
Oh, sure, yeah, sure. Combined ops, Supreme Allied Commander, Southeast Asia. He saw this in a much different way to the chiefs of staff. They were hanging on rigidly to what they got. And their formula, quite frankly, was a formula of why you didn't do things. It was a fail-safe formula rather than a formula of taking positive action. They were more concerned to see that you didn't do this, this, and this because of the direction it may lead you, rather than that you could do this, this, and this. Mind you, you can go too far the other way, but I think that they dragged their feet a bit to a varying degree. I don't think any of the chiefs really support him. Hull certainly didn't. Pike didn't. Really, Caspar John didn't. The next chiefs after that, Elworthy, and they were a little bit festing later on. They were a bit better.
Do you think that the ideas came primarily from Mountbatten or primarily from Macmillan and his two wise men?
Well, I think a bit of both, really. They came very much from Mountbatten. But Mountbatten was wise enough to see that if they'd just gone up with his name on it and no one else's, there would have been terrible resistance. And so Macmillan himself had been very dissatisfied with the Ministry of Defence. And, of course, the authority of Jacob and Ismay was a very great uplift. And, of course, one has to remember that Jacob and Ismay did actually propose a third stage, which we have never yet reached, and maybe shouldn't reach, and that was a unification of the three services. And that is the interesting thing. Not at every level, but from full colonel, brigadier above, they thought everybody should be wear the same uniform and be in a common role. But they reckoned it would take some time to reach that. And the cabinet approved the first stage, or rather the second stage, because the first stage really did nothing but tinker about with it. But they didn't actually ever approve the unification of the services.
That's interesting, because both Ismay and Jacob were army officers, weren't they?
Yes. And they both thought that after a certain stage you should go on a common row.
Now, Mountbatten has been compared in some sources to an Italian Renaissance prince,
yeah,
in his mentality. And you said that he had enormous ambition, but given his lineage and his accomplishments, how could he possibly have ambition? What more could he want?
You mean what more could he want, having been viceroy?
Having been viceroy, being of the blood royal, having commanded at so many levels.
Well, his first ambition had been realised, of course, and that was to avenge the indignity that was done to his father at the beginning of the First World War, when his father was hounded out of office because of his German extraction. Well, he'd done that. It was not so much ambition to arrive at which he'd already done, but it was to achieve his own visions, really, to get his own way. in the things that he believed were important. This was what I meant by ambition. And he used to use every trick in the book. I mean, one very small example of how the chiefs and Mountbatten were in conflict was that Mountbatten recognized pretty accurately that patronage and who wrote your confidential report was a very important part in loyalty. And so he wanted to have as Defence Services Secretary a four-star officer who was over and above the Naval Secretary, the Military Secretary and the Air Secretary. And the Chiefs of Staff wanted to keep the patronage in their own hands, and they wanted a Defence Service Secretary who nearly did coordination and was junior to these, which is what is now happens, but started off the other way. And I remember one Chiefs of Staff meeting coming in, Mountbatten coming in and said, gentlemen, I was spending last weekend with the Queen at Windsor Castle, and she said how delighted she was to hear that we were going to have a four-star Defence Services Secretary. And, of course, you could see them all grinding their teeth because he knew perfectly well that the Queen wouldn't pontificate on a comparatively trivial matter like that, and probably didn't even know about it. So they knew that he was telling a lie, and he probably knew they knew he was telling a lie, but he tried it on to try to put sort of subtle pressure on the chiefs.
Do you think he was amoral?
Well, I suppose who of those people who've reached tremendous office in the world, I mean, the Caesars, the Napoleons, the Wellingtons, Wellington's rather a different matter, I think, I'm not comparing him with it, but the Hitlers and the people who haven't used these things in an unscrupulous way to get what they want.
Well, you can justify a lesser evil in terms of avoiding a greater evil.
Yes, I mean, telling a white lie or a fib can hardly be compared to sending people to a gas chamber or something like that. I mean, I think you've got to look at this in moderation. But he did believe that within moderation, the end justifies the means. And I can remember another time when about the only time they agreed on anything was about that the War Office shouldn't be used for the Ministry of Aviation. And the chief said to Mountbatten, you must lead us to the Secretary of State and say, Secretary of State, we won't put up this. Right, he said, I'll do that. And this was going to happen on the Monday. On the Friday night, they all got a letter saying, I'm sorry, my doctor says I'm not well and I must take it easy and I'm afraid I can't be there, but you give the minister hell. And all that. And he then wrote to the minister and said, don't listen to a word these buggers say. And when you said, Admiral, you cannot do that, he said, why not? I'm right and they're wrong. He was absolutely self-centred on this and a very demanding man to work for, but he had one point which endeared him to me, and that is was he took his staff completely into his confidence in a way that most senior officers one wasn't used to at that stage. You'd sit round at morning prayers and you'd kick things around and you had felt you had every right to say what you thought should happen as he had, and he listened to you on that basis. And he called it the philosophy of the hive, that you've got these ideas by winning. This was very flattering to a comparatively young 37 or 38 year old lieutenant colonel who felt that he could talk on equal terms to a chairman.
It has been said that he was broad minded and that he would listen to all points of view
Absolutely.
Before making his mind up.
Absolutely. That is right. And he certainly there. That is absolutely true.
Did he ever change his mind as a result of receiving advice or discussion?
Yes, I think he did. Yes, I think he did.
Was he tolerant of error? Or was he absolutely exacting?
Well, I think if you were honest, you got. I never had an absolute sort of clout. No, I was always treated very well. But, I mean, I don't think he would send for you, let's say all times of the day and night. He'd expect you to work incredibly long hours. He never sort of said, you know, how's your wife and family, or did you, you know, what sort of weekend did you have, or anything like that. He was thinking in a plane above all that. And he reminds one of Churchill, you see, Ian Jacob, who was Churchill's staff officer, assistant staff officer, all through the war. And someone said, how do you get on with Churchill? He said, I don't really know what you mean. He treats me as part of the furniture. Now, my bat intended to be that, you know. But it was an exciting roller coaster ride with him, which one wouldn't have missed.
And ultimately, he did outflank his opponents, didn't he?
He did what?
Outflank his opponents.
He got his way. Outflank, yeah. Take him in the flank. He preferred to do it that way. And he used his staff pretty blatantly. I mean, you were shoved out. You were the chap who was told to go and do this. And then when all the fire was directed on you, that was fine, and he'd then see where the fire was coming from, and he'd get round the other side.
You were the covering force.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was, you know, that was quite a rough, but it was good experience. And you got some pretty, you know, from your own service, you got some pretty, pretty tough sort of things, because you were seen to be Mountbatten's man.
Did that apply also to his naval and air force?
Yes.
Staff.
Oh, I think so. Certainly his Air Force. Certainly his Air Force. And I think to a certain extent the Navy. I mean, he wasn't all that popular in the Navy. He wasn't.
One always gets the impression that of the three services, it's the Air Force which is the most on the lookout for threats to its existence and interests and the quickest to act politically to defend them. Did you get that impression during this time, that the Air Force was the most active and skillful in trying to defend its individual service interests against collectivisation?
Yes, I'm not sure on this particular issue, but of course later on the question of the aircraft versus the carriers, they certainly did this. The thing is that being the youngest service, they were always the one most on the defensive. I mean, ever since Trenchard's day, the RAF have been geared to defending the Royal Air Force against a, admittedly decreasing, but a powerful lobby of the other two services to say that the Air Force is not necessary. I mean, even comparatively recently, Field Marshal Carver's on record of saying, of course, the cheapest way to make a defence review is do away with the Air Force. They're quite unnecessary. This has been, I mean, certainly in the days of Beatty and the earlier chiefs, there was this great pressure to say you don't need an air force. Well, I think, of course, you know, Battle of Britain and all the rest of it. I mean, I think you're talking in a cloud cuckoo land if you think you can do away. But you know, they are very defensive and they spend a great deal of effort in making sure that these sort of ideas don't crop up again. On this particular reorganisation, I wouldn't have said they were the strongest. I would have said the army were the people who were most suspicious of Mountbatten's thing, but that was in the personality of Field Marshal Howe, I think.
Do you think it did do you any damage, temporary damage, having been associated with Mountbatten?
To me?
Yes.
Well, it didn't seem to have done very much. It didn't really seem to have done very much. I went and commanded the battalion afterwards, and I then went up the command chain, brigade, division, Hong Kong, Commander-in-Chief, CGS, CDS. You can't actually ask for much more than that. So it didn't seem to have done any damage.
Shall we move on then to your command of the battalion? I think this was the time when you wrote your pamphlet on leadership, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And various other things on training directives.
I think in 1965, you went off to be commanding officer of the 2nd Battalion in Malaysia.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I was very lucky because battalion unusually was about to embark, having spent its war as a motor battalion and all its time really in the United Kingdom or Germany, was about to embark on a Far East tour, which would involve operations connected with the Indonesian confrontation of Malaysia, which had just started. And so I got command of this battalion just as they were finishing their time with the strategic reserve in England. We're going out to Malaya as a, on a 2 to 3 year tour to be based in a place called Penang on the west island off the west coast of Malaysia. And from there, we would undertake various operational tours in East Malaysia along the Indonesian border. It was a wonderful time to take command, and I, all my period of command was out in the Far East and involved operations periodically throughout the whole tour.
When you got out to Penang, how long do you reckon it took for the battalion to get itself acclimatized before it was capable of working?
Well, we had to. We arrived out in just about Christmas, early January 1965. It's early January. And we had to be ready for the jungle in April. So we had 3 months to get ready, and then we went on our tour of duty to the 1st Division in Malaysia, which was in the south of Kuching on the Indonesian border, which was quite an active area.
So you had 3 months of training.
Climatization, training, visiting the jungle warfare school in Johor Bahru, and getting ready for the operations that we had to do.
Was it difficult for the battalion to adapt from its previous role as a motor battalion to one of jungle warfare?
Well, they hadn't come, of course, straight from being a motor battalion, because in the last few years they had done Berlin, strategic reserve from Colchester, and they had done a tour in Guyana, British Guyana. So the jungle wasn't completely new to them, as it might have been. But it was a new challenge, and I think that the British Army is very good at adapting itself to these sort of things. I mean, we started with a new set of rules. And I have here my first training directive to everybody in the battalion, all officers and warrant officers and sergeants, which I issued on the battalion policy for 1965. So that was, that happens to be one that I sent to the ORQMS, but I mean it is, it was addressed to various people personally. And we had on the whole very successful tours. There was a very interesting particular type of operation that was that we had to take part in. I mean, the confrontation was conducted by having a whole lot of patrol bases, defended patrol bases along the border, from which patrols went out to try and ambush any Indonesians' incursions over the border. And later on, of course, to actually go over the far side of the border and harass them. And then the idea was that the patrols going out from these patrol bases will either ambush or identify any large-scale incursions, and then the brigadier or the director of operations would move his mobile reserves by helicopter to counteract these penetrations. And that was the way the whole thing was conducted. And it gradually made the Indonesians realize that there was no future in this particular type of operation. And then eventually that and other factors and the overthrow of Sukarno eventually brought confrontation to its end without escalation.
What sort of scale would your patrols be? Were these section patrols or platoon patrols, or would the scale depend entirely on the local situation?
Well, it did, but I would have thought that, generally speaking, they were sort of half-platoon patrols, that sort of thing. And they went out for at least a week and sometimes 10 days.
What sort of distance?
Sort of 15 men, that sort of thing.
What sort of distance could a patrol hope to cover in that time?
Well, of course, the country was very, very bad. To get the whole art of successful ambush was to walk in so that you couldn't be detected. If you helicoptered in, then people would know where you were going. To walk in and helicopter out was the drill. And the other thing was, if you wanted to go and ambush a track, never walk down a track to get there. So you always had to come across country and come in on the side, set up your patrol base, go down onto the track. Now, that meant that you were very often going across the grain of the ground, you were going through very difficult country. And this took a very considerable time to get to. So, your patrol might be going, it takes several days to get there, but it might be taking 4 or 5 miles or something like that to get to a particular place, but it might take a great many days to get to that particular place. It might not have to go quite as far. But you would walk in, whether it was over the border. I think that there was as far as I remember, over the border, which is still classified information, but it doesn't matter in a thing like this. I think it was 10,000 yards was the depth that you were allowed to go to over the border, but then a lot of tracks ran, and the border was very imprecise.
When you were selecting sites for ambushes or picking out places to send your more aggressive patrols to look for the other side's patrol bases, did you act upon the basis of deduction from looking at maps or on the basis of hard intelligence?
Well, maps came into it, but you did get a certain amount of intelligence about tracks being used, a certain amount of photography and reconnaissance, and also from the use of locals, intelligence and people who crossed the border and so on, information from that. So I would have thought that you, on the whole, you did it on intelligence of one sort or another, gleaned in one way and another. It might be from radio, it might be from talking to the locals.
Were the people who were actually opposing you in this area regular soldiers, or were they militia?
No, very much regular soldiers. And more than regular soldiers, special forces. And in fact, they were led, the opposite number to me during that time is a chap I have since got to know extremely well, General Benny Madani, who was head of intelligence and present Minister of Defence in Indonesia now. And we often meet and discuss these particular things.
What sort of quality were the enemy and their tactics?
They're very good. The Javanese, they were mostly Javanese, and the Javanese are very good fighters and very good soldiers. They were good. And, of course, there were some very nasty... most of our ambushes and things were successful, and we didn't have any direct attack, but there was a very nasty attack on a forward patrol base in the next door sector to us, manned by the parachutists. And only the valour of the sergeant major,
who got a DCM and I think ended up as quartermaster at the Staff College, but I'm not certain, saved the day from the whole post being overrun. And so there were some quite big attacks by the Indonesians on forward bases. About two or three or so.
By quite big, what sort of scale would it be?
Oh, well,
battalion?
Company to battalion, that sort of size, yes. Company plus.
What sort of equipment did they have? And weapons? Were they a reasonable type and quality?
They didn't have very much. They had mortars. Good small arms. Mortars. Anti-tank rockets, well, rockets really, which could have been used on bunkers and things like that. Pretty good equipment. Helicopters, a lot of helicopters. Russian helicopters. Not a great deal of artillery, but then we didn't have much artillery either.
Do you think that artillery...
Very much an infantry war.
Do you think that artillery would have been useful if you'd had it?
Well, I wouldn't say we didn't have any. We did. We had the 105mm towed gun, and I can remember lifting these up underslung on a helicopter and then taking it to pieces and carrying the bits of a 105 up a jungle path so as it could be put right onto the border to get the maximum range. And so we did use this artillery, but there was no mass of artillery. It was used individual guns. Yes, I mean, I think it would have been useful. It would have been. We did it. Occasionally, we